Welcome to China Talk, a series of interviews with leading global experts on China and East Asia. The series is produced jointly by the Polish-Chinese Business Council and SWPS University here, Warsaw, Poland. This is yet another meeting in the series. The series is run on the management space of SWPS University, so please feel free to look at our previous meetings and conversations in this series, which are all in a dedicated YouTube channel and on the website of the management space. The interviews are hosted by the president of the Polish-Chinese Business Council, Mr. Zbigniew Niesiołbęcki. Zbigniew, hello.
Hello.
And myself, I'm Marcin Jacobi. I'm head of the Department of Asian Studies at SWPS University. Our special guest is Mr. David Dollar, a senior fellow in the China Center at Brookings Institution, a very well-known, well-established American institution, and he's an expert on economics, international trade. He also has, within the Brookings Institution, his own series of podcasts called Dollar and Cents. And he's been working for many, many years. He worked for more than 20 years at World Bank, being a country economist for Vietnam, and then working as a researcher. Most of his papers are from the time when he worked at the World Bank in the research department. And then later, from 2004 to 2009, he was country director for China and Mongolia. And swiftly from there, he started working for the US Treasuries as economic and financial emissary. So we have with us an expert on China, on the economy, working at World Bank and US Treasury, and now Brookings Institution. David, welcome.
Thank you. It's really a great pleasure to connect with you.
Thank you very much for finding time to be here with us, finding time in a very busy schedule. And I pass over to Zbigniew for the first question.
As Professor Jacobi said, the topic of our webinar is today's structural reforms in China. I'm very happy that we can host David Dollar today, undoubtedly one of the world's greatest authorities, the leading expert in this field. David, before we move to the topic of our webinar and the future, I would like that we determine where the Chinese economy is now and what is the balance of economic reforms under Xi Jinping's reign far.
Well, thank you again for inviting me. I think this is a very important first question. To be honest, Xi Jinping has a pretty bad reputation in the United States and across the West. And I think that he's definitely done things to tighten up the political situation in China. That has led to a certain confusion on the part of Western analysts. So you often hear the expression that Xi Jinping has backtracked on economic reform. And I don't think that's accurate or a fair assessment. I think he has a mixed record on structural reforms. China is a very complicated place, and so it's possible to have progress in some areas and backtracking in other areas. So I would say China's made a lot of progress reforming the financial system. You know, they've opened up to more new entrants from foreign firms and domestic private banks. There's more flexibility of interest rates and the exchange rate. And if you're paying attention, you see that they're allowing bonds to default for some big state enterprises that are in financial trouble to default rather than bailing them out. I view all of that as progress toward a more market-oriented financial system. At the same time, you've also seen what you might call persecution of Jack Ma, one of the most important private entrepreneurs in China. You know, the value of his company has gone down about 30% just in the last few months as the government has restricted the ability of Alibaba to do various things. So you could say that's a kind of expropriation. Communist parties trying to make decisions in big private firms. So I view that as backtracking. And then one other structural area I would mention, which I care about a lot, one of the really dramatic features of China now is going to be demographic change with the aging of the population and eventually decline of the labor force. And this is going to be a real challenge for the economy. The risk of oversimplification, you know, one of the best responses to that is to encourage more labor mobility to get more flexibility in the labor market, because you're going to have, like, Shanghai, for example, is even older than China on average. It's aging very quickly. If you don't have more immigration into Shanghai, it'll be very hard to sustain the economy. And China has this household registration system. And again, it's a mixed story where there's a certain amount of liberalization, particularly in medium-sized cities, but still very tight restrictions in a place like Shanghai or Guangzhou or some of the most productive cities in China. So I think when you look at the structural reform landscape, it's a complicated picture of progress in some important areas, backtracking in other areas. In general, I would characterize it as two steps forward, one step back. So China is continuing to reform, just not as quickly as we all wish it would.
I agree that that period of its reign can be assessed differently. Yes, some will consider the country's economic growth, increase in urbanization, for example, start with new global projects such as BRI, or achievement of leadership position in some new technologies. Others can emphasize a lack of progress in reforming the economy, such as zombie state-owned companies in the field of environmental protection and growing problems in the relation, for example, in the U.S. So you say that this two steps ahead, one back. And this is what the experts underline, that Chinese reforms has indeed occurred trial error, according to Deng Xiaoping's reform analogy, crossing the river by filling the stones. That underscores his conviction that motion comes first and the fixing problem second. Does this demonstrate, in your opinion, the pragmatism or rather the lack of the proper diagnosis, inability to introduce changes, or a lack of will to make radical reforms that could, for example, have enough social cost?
Very good question. I think in a lot of ways, these developments in China are overdetermined in a sense. They've got multiple determinants. So definitely Xi Jinping's ideology, his commitment to socialism is one factor. You know, he wants to maintain a strong role for state enterprises and for the Communist Party of China. And I do think that that interferes with some potential reforms. But I would put more weight on what I think of as special interest politics. You know, China has politics just as the United States does, and Poland has politics. We all have to deal with different interest groups. For example, I mentioned the issue of the reforming the household registration system, the hukou system. Well, in those really top cities like Shanghai, you've got a very comfortable population, you know, that doesn't really want a lot of, you know, they actually call the other Chinese outsiders. You know, at first when I lived in Beijing and they talked about outsiders, I thought they meant me. And then I realized, no, actually, they were talking about people from the rest of China. They don't particularly want influx of people from different parts of China, speaking different dialects, bringing different customs, et cetera. So you've got that middle class in places like Beijing and Shanghai. They have quite a bit of power in the sense that the Communist Party is not going to make decisions that really upset, you know, a large number of the middle class. Or the state enterprises, they still have a significant employment. That's an important group. Almost all of them are Communist Party members. So when they talk about reforming state enterprises, they have to think about the several million members of the party who work in state enterprises. So they've got complicated politics just as the rest of us do. And then you've got the ideology overlaid on top of that.
If we talk to politics issues, so it's very difficult for the people from Western countries to understand the central role of the state in all aspects of economic management and life with the free market economy. However, following the data from the Chinese economy, it turns out that seems impossible under Chinese condition does work. What is your opinion on this? Can those who deny the principles of liberalism in many countries and call for increasing the state presence in the economy refer to the Chinese example?
Thank you again. Another good question. China obviously has a mixed economy with a large dynamic private sector. You know, I mentioned the big firms like Alibaba, but actually the backbone of the Chinese economy would be medium-sized private firms, names we've never heard of that have 300 or 400 workers. You know, that's where most of the export success comes from. But then you've got a large state enterprise sector. So you've got some of the biggest banks in the world, state-owned, biggest telecom companies, energy companies in a range of sectors. So it's definitely very complicated. And what it does for social scientists is it gives very fertile ground for argument. So I look at China, and I started going there in 1986. I was teaching there in 1986. I was actually part of a work unit, and I had ration cards, and I actually got to experience living in a socialist planned economy for about half a year. And, you know, frankly, it was terribly inefficient and had all kinds of problems and distortions. So I look at China as starting from where it was completely planned and getting to where it's mostly private sector and mostly that medium-sized private sector. The Communist Party's not running enterprises with 300 or 400 workers. There's tens of millions of enterprises. So frankly, there's not enough Communist Party members to run those enterprises. They're certainly interfering with Jack Ma and Alibaba, but I don't see them interfering in most of the private sector. So I see China's success driven by the private sector. But I can see how someone else could look at the same data and say, well, China has a bigger state sector than Poland, for example, other Eastern European countries, Latin America, most of Southeast Asia. China's doing really, really well. So maybe the lesson is the rest of us are too capitalistic and we don't have large enough state sectors. So, you know, it's a fertile area for argument. But to me, when they had a completely planned system, it was a disaster economically that led to starvation. Not much talking about freedom and human rights, which are important, but this was a country that generated poverty, an economy that generated poverty. And it's only when they moved toward capitalism that they started improving. So to me, that's really the key thing is that emergence of the private sector, private initiative.
Yeah, we had very similar experiences in Poland in the 1980s. I would like to just ask you here, because we very often tend to think in very simple terms that, you know, we have the Western capitalism and then we had the Chinese socialist system, planned economy, and China, you know, looked at our systems and tried to incorporate the changes. But then there is a huge role of other Eastern European countries, such as Singapore, such as South Korea, such as Japan. Did they play a part in building the sort of Chinese mixed capitalism and state interference in the economy system?
You know, we can have kind of a big meta argument about capitalism versus, you know, government intervention, government planning, whatever you want to call it. But I think it's more interesting to go down to a more micro level and go policy by policy. To me, you know, your question emphasizes that China has been remarkably open to foreign investment. And this is actually unusual. We sometimes think of China following an East Asian model that earlier we saw from Japan or South Korea. But frankly, both Japan and South Korea worked very hard to keep foreign investors out of their countries. So you go to those Japan or South Korea, in Japan, you see Japanese brands. In Korea, you see Korean brands. China, you go to China and you see Western brands, right? It's Volkswagen and Audi and Ford and Chrysler that are out there on the roads, the vehicles. They're using Samsung iPhones and Apple iPhones. They're using Korean and Japanese brand television sets, for example. So, you know, I think that's a striking thing about China, that they allowed in the foreign investment. And that helped generate a very competitive economy relatively quickly, because they had you mentioned foreign investors from Singapore, Japan, South Korea, eventually Europe and the United States. Now, did some of the Asians influence them in that industrial policy direction? I think the answer to that is yes.
Yeah, what I meant was the idea of the role of the state in running the economy, a very sort of hands-on type of view of a capitalist economy.
Yeah, and I think there's no question, at least until recently, you know, China had very close ties with South Korea there for a while. Relations are bad right now for a variety of reasons, but Korean foreign investment played a very important role. And I've been in meetings between Korean entrepreneurs and Chinese officials where the Korean entrepreneurs are praising the industrial policy and various statist policies from the Chinese government side.
David, you are the co-author of extremely interesting book, China 2049, Economic Challenges of Rising Global Power, which was created thanks to cooperation of economists from China's Peking University and Brookings Institute. In this book, you analyzed a number of areas of the Chinese economy and society and formulated recommendations for structural reforms in each area to achieve centennial goals. Before we get into specific issues, could you please introduce us very short to the formulated goals and about this book?
You know, China, as part of their government involvement in the economy, they have very specific goals for the future. You know, they have short-term goals, like one was to double GDP per capita between 2010 and 2020, which is now over. But then more general goals to achieve a well-off society. 2049 is obviously an important year because it's the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic. I appreciate you bringing up the book. Thank you. I think the main thing it showed is even in the current environment, which is a pretty tense environment between China and the United States, we were able to put together a research team, you know, with contributions from both sides. We didn't try to agree on everything. It's an edited book, but I would say we were all pretty much in the same ballpark. I personally have no problem with some of the ideas about government intervention. I'm definitely not a neoliberal economist. I think the United States right now, for example, has too little government intervention in the economy as far as I'm concerned. I still think China has too much in some areas. But you could argue there are other areas, for example, environmental control, where China has too little government, frankly. You know, they could use more regulation and control in certain areas of pollution and carbon emissions. So I think it was an effort to have a good conversation between American-based economists and Chinese-based economists about what are the key reforms they really need to meet their aspiration to be a well-off society.
I want to return to our previous discussion about the structure of Chinese economy and to the private and state-owned sector. I can only add that the data from the economy show us that the private sector now is much more profitable and have dealt much better with the crisis caused by COVID-19 pandemic. So the restructuring of the state-owned company has been on the agenda for many years in China. China's last idea is the biggest mixed owner reforms the state-owned enterprises. How do you assess the idea of partial privatization and its feasibility in Chinese conditions?
I'm not a big fan of partial privatization. You know, I would encourage China to, you know, take a strategic look at its state enterprise sector. And I accept that they're going to continue to have some state enterprises, but I think they need to think hard about what are the particular sectors, goods and services that they want provided by state enterprises. When you start getting into mixed ownership, to me, it then becomes confusing. What is the objective? If it's just going to operate like a private company, well, then frankly, you're better off just privatizing it. So I would prefer that they have a mixed system in the sense of retaining some state enterprises, but getting rid of others. Now, the other thing I would add is you've got different types of state enterprises in China. They're not going to give up on their big centrally owned enterprises in quite a few sectors. But they also have a lot of state enterprises owned at the city level. And when you look at these bond defaults that they're starting to allow, those are often these locally owned state enterprises. So this is an important development where they're basically saying the state is not going to bail out the locally owned state enterprises. And that means the financial sector is going to start treating them differently, putting them in a more competitive situation. And apparently they're going to let some of these enterprises go bankrupt, which means their assets get sold to the private sector. So I think in a quiet kind of way, you will see more privatization of those local state enterprises, but they're going to continue to hang on to the big central state enterprises.
For many years, China has based its dynamic development on production and export. According to experts, these two growth engines has exhausted their potential and need to be replaced. In this context, I would like to refer to the flying geese pattern. It's not a new concept. Yes, they are used to refer to Asian economies and mean, briefly speaking, that production capacity is relocated from the countries with higher production costs to places where it's possible to produce cheaper. So production costs in China have risen significantly. And the COVID-19 pandemic has changed the risk assessment of over-concentration of global supply chains. Do you think we will see a massive relocation of factories from China to other countries in the coming years? What do you think needs to happen for the flying geese pattern to be realized in China case in massive scale, in large scale?
Right. So I would say no to the question of whether we're going to see massive change. You know, there's a lot of talk in the United States about trying to get value chains, supply chains to move out of China, maybe come back to the U.S. This is frankly completely unrealistic and is not happening at all, despite Donald Trump's policies. U.S. manufacturing actually went into recession before the coronavirus started. And I think the U.S. trade war was one of the reasons why U.S. manufacturing was going into recession. So whatever we were doing was not particularly helping manufacturing in the United States. But I do think, if I could just make a couple of points, I agree with your assessment that the role of exports in China's development has changed. You know, China's the largest exporting nation. You know, it used to be their exports were growing at 20%+ per year. That's not going to happen anymore, not once you're the biggest player. You know, so it can't play the same role as before. And plus, you will see some of this flying geese phenomenon you're talking about. Before the pandemic hit, we were already seeing some labor-intensive assembly shift out of China and going to places like Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia, Bangladesh, countries with lower wages. Meanwhile, China has moved up in a lot of value chains, and it's producing machinery and intermediate components. And so I don't think that phenomenon we should think of as value chains leaving China. I see it more as an evolution of value chains. You know, just to give you a very specific example that was accelerated by the trade war, you know, the U.S. put tariffs on a lot of relatively simple products. For example, we were buying all of our Christmas lights, you know, Christmas lights for trees and houses. We were buying all of those from China, and then we put a 25% tariff on. And this year, Christmas season, we bought them all from Cambodia. So the tariffs had an effect, but then you dig a little deeper. It's mostly Chinese companies who moved final assembly to Cambodia, but they were producing a lot of the inputs and the machinery, plus they're the capitalists running these firms. So there's a lot of Chinese value added, and it used to go directly from China to the US, and now it goes to Cambodia, which adds a little additional value added, comes to the United States. So I think we'll see evolution of value chains, mostly for economic reasons. That last example was accelerated by the political development. But that kind of value chain, it's not going to come back to the United States. And, you know, companies are going to be taking a hard look at their value chains in terms of resiliency. But I think this notion that there's going to be large changes because of the pandemic, I'm skeptical about that until I see it happen.
So the latest data shows that China is increasing its share of the world trade during the pandemic. In this situation, will China be willing to give up being the world's factory? Maybe in this area, which you mentioned, the low-added products, maybe yes, but the main products will be produced in China.
I think we're going to continue to see complex value chains, particularly in electronics and automobiles. Even garments and textiles has a pretty complicated set of value chains. And I think, you know, as I said, China's moving up more into the middle, producing machinery and sophisticated components. I call it the middle, you know, because a lot of value chains start with intellectual property, you know, owned by Europeans or by Americans. That's our main contribution to value chains comes from the services of intellectual property, meaning patents, the use of patents and brand names. But now China is becoming important, producing machinery and sophisticated components. And it's good if labor-intensive assembly moves to some of these poorer countries. That can be a real impetus for development in places like Vietnam and Indonesia.
But then here, if I may add, you know, China for several years has been the biggest country registering new patents around the world. And it's been moving very, very quickly high up the sort of intellectual property ladder. Do you see China as not needing American and European patents in foreseeable future as much as they rely on these patents and all this know-how now?
I think from an economic point of view, it would be in China's interest to continue to use patents from Europe and the United States and to pay royalties for that or to let the foreign investors come in. Because while it's hard to measure these things, there is some evidence that China is producing low quality patents. And, you know, we don't really see impressive technological upgrading of all of Chinese industry. There's some specific successes, AI, for example, drone technology. So we should acknowledge that. But we don't really see impressive technological development across the board in China. And I subscribe to the view that we're all better off if we have an open innovation system with competition. To some extent, China is moving in that direction. You know, their recent agreement with ASEAN, the so-called Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, that includes a moderately strong chapter on intellectual property rights protection. And their new investment agreement with the EU is aimed at, you know, essentially protecting European companies against forced technology transfer and taking steps to improve intellectual property rights. So I think, as in many other areas, there's a struggle going on in China. You know, you definitely have a statist group that would like to close off the economy and kind of create their own technology and standards. But that's a recipe for, you know, for economic failure. And then the kind of people I work with at different Chinese universities, they're all in favor of opening up the economy more. They think Chinese companies will thrive in a very competitive environment with good intellectual property rights. But so will European companies, so will American companies.
Yeah, since you mentioned the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment and EU, I would like to bring up some of the questions we have from the audience. There is a series of questions about the CAI and whether it's a opportunity for the EU, what are the benefits for the countries of the European Union, and what would be the impact of comprehensive agreement on transatlantic relations? You know, where are the interests?
Right. So I'm cautiously optimistic about the EU-China agreement. And I say that I'm cautious because I think we have to admit that overall rule of law is not that strong in China, not as strong in China as it is in European countries, for example. So when you sign an agreement, there will be some question as to how exactly the Chinese follow the agreement. Plus, China's a big, complicated country. So if you're entrenched in some city in the middle of China, you know, that let's just wait and see how much protection you actually get, you know, because the EU, you know, bosses signed a treaty with Xi Jinping. But I'm optimistic because I think this is a smart move for both China and for Europe. I don't favor the trade war that the U.S. has been prosecuting against China. I don't believe in decoupling. I think that's completely unrealistic and will lead to a impoverished world that's more likely to have strife. So I think for Europe to try to reach an agreement that addresses concerns about state enterprises, subsidies, forced technology transfer, I think that makes a lot of sense. The Biden administration, signaled that they wanted to coordinate with Europe and they wish Europe would wait. But I like the idea of coordinating, but I'm not sure what vehicle or instrument they're talking about. I mean, the same Biden group is saying they don't want to sign any big new trade agreements. They got a lot of things on their plate. They're not going to be negotiating trade or investment agreements. To me, coordination, if you're not getting into some big agreement together, then it just sounds like talk. You know, I'm happy to see Europe acting rather than just talking. And I'm happy to see China signing both the RCEP and the European Investment Agreement, because I think China needs to open up more. And these are steps in the right direction.
Yeah, just to follow that with some more questions, Stanislav asks, if you could comment on the Chinese foreign direct investments in the European Union. Do you think that after CAI, they will increase, decrease? Is there any threat from China in this respect for the EU?
Well, I don't think we have all the details from the treaty yet, to be frank. But my sense is Europe is quite open and, if anything, has introduced some security restrictions, which I support. And I don't see that those are changed in any way by this treaty. So I don't really think China gets very much in terms of access because Europe was already open. Seems to me the main change here is China is committing to opening up more sectors and protecting intellectual property rights. I guess from a Chinese point of view, they've been worried about the U.S. trade war and the potential for this to spread. So I guess the protection that China gets, in a sense, is that Europe is committing to not changing its openness. But I don't see that Europe has become more open because of this treaty.
What is worth to underline that emphasized that the data published by Peterson Institute for International Economics, that the inbound foreign direct investments in China is on the track to hit the new record in 2020. Yes, how we can comment it, especially in this context on performed decoupling and changes in supply chains?
The world was in recession in 2020, and I don't know the exact data, but my guess is probably direct investment went down globally. But as you say, it's going up in China. That just contradicts this idea that decoupling is happening. Maybe parts of the U.S. economy is decoupling from China, but when we look at the whole global economy, there are a lot of indicators that China is more integrated with the global system. Its share of exports went up last year. Its direct foreign investment into China is going up. Their direct investment going out probably declined last year, if I had to guess. But I think that's going to be temporary. I think China will come back, continue to be one of the important investors in the world. So I think the reality is not decoupling. The reality is China becoming more integrated with the global system. And that creates a very complicated world because obviously, we have very different political systems, but the real question for the West is, can we have an economic and other relationship with China despite differences in the political system? And I think the European answer tends to be that, yes, we can have a relationship where the U.S. is debating this at the moment.
Maybe this record and outbound direct investment in China is connected with and the growing role of consumption as the main economic driver in the new five-year plan. Yes, this is the consumption is the main game changer in this plan, we can say. So in your book, you underline that household consumption in the future will be tremendously large in China and will be the major export market for most countries.
Right. So I think we already discussed how while exports are still important for China, they are of relatively less importance than in the past. That kind of export-led period is over. And we didn't talk too much about the financial system, but I mentioned the the growing bond defaults in the financial system. Overall, we see quite a bit of fragility in the financial system in China, you know, which I take as an indication that they've overinvested in quite a few sectors. They've overbuilt the capital stock, you know, and that's creating some problems. So when you start looking at the sources of growth on the demand side, if exports have maxed out their potential and investment has diminishing returns, what you're left with is consumption, you know, and then a lot of their goals are really about making the quality of people's lives better. So it's a consistent. So I think we will see a rising share of consumption in GDP in China. And so when you look at that foreign direct investment that you mentioned, you know, a lot of that is in consumer-oriented sectors. It used to be that most of the foreign investment into China was in manufacturing, and I think a lot of it was export-oriented. But now the vast majority of investment into China is in the service sector. You know, your French colleagues, for example, they're excited about getting into healthcare, private healthcare in China. That's going to expand enormously because the number of old people is going to double within a relatively short period of time. So you're going to have a lot of interesting, diverse consumption opportunities there, and you're going to have a lot of the inward investment aimed at that. All of our topics are interrelated. So, you know, again, I was expressing skepticism about this idea that value chains would leave China. If a lot of the investment is aimed at servicing Chinese consumers, then of course they're not going to leave China. That doesn't make any sense at all. You know, so I think some of this discussion in the West is just not based in facts.
If I can just add here another question from the audience about the supposed dissonance between what you just discussed, the domestic consumption, and then focusing more on this rather than on export, and Chinese participation in RCEP and signing of the RCEP and being quite interested in sort of maybe cooperating more with ASEAN region as far as Chinese exports are concerned.
Right. So when I talk about the coming to the end of a period of export-led development in China, that was a period where China started out very isolated from the world and began to enter the world economy. And you could have sectors like textiles and footwear, you know, growing at 25% per year because you start out as a tiny player and then you develop you kind of your fair share. And that really spurred that growth of over 10% per year that we saw for a long time. So I was arguing that that's over. But just as for any other advanced economy, you know, Poland, for example, it's going to be hard to grow at those super high rates. I don't think China will be growing in the high single digits anymore. But you still benefit enormously by integration with the global economy because that does enable your firms to specialize in what they do well. And it enables you to import technologies and other products from other partners. And it creates the most competitive market. You know, I'm a big fan of creating maximum competition. And for most of us, if we don't have openness to the world market, we're going to end up with monopolies or oligopolies. So I think it's still in China's interest to integrate with ASEAN and with Europe. But it's not going to have the same kind of macroeconomic impetus that it had 10, 15 years ago.
Let's shift focus to the next structural problem analyzed in your book. This means the middle income trap. So it can be said that this is a common problem that many countries grapple with and only a few have dealt with. It's widely recognized that the way to avoid the middle income trap is through the fundamental progress in productivity and efficiency achieved by increasing innovation. It's therefore necessary to support development of technological ecosystem inter alia through the development of the education system, basic research, joint research project, and ensuring the transition of innovation from science to industry. What challenges in China facing in this regard? What necessary reforms must China undertake if it is to avoid the middle income trap?
So I think it's useful to distinguish two different types of policies to spur innovation. the more generic, you know, affecting the overall environment for innovation, and then the, you know, the more specific industrial policy, like let's become a leader in semiconductors or AI. So I have complete support for the first set of policies. And I think China is making considerable progress. You know, the basics there are intellectual property rights protection, creating great universities. China's turning out literally millions of what we call STEM graduates every year, kids studying science, technology, engineering, mathematics. They're spending more than 2% of GDP on research and development. You know, so they have a lot of pluses. But I think in terms of really moving to the kind of same league as the advanced economies, they need to still do more on intellectual property rights protection, where they have a lot of good laws on the books. But I think enforcement and penalties are not really sufficient. And then they are going to start running into some contradictions. You know, they're building up some really good universities, but I happen to think that an environment of free speech is really essential for great universities. And there is, you know, a lot of censorship of different types of speech in China, obviously, just the basics. If, you know, if you're sitting there at a Chinese university, you can't open your iPad and access the New York Times or Bloomberg or a whole bunch. You know, you can't get on Twitter and communicate with the rest of the world. So, you know, I think as China moves up the ladder, in a sense, their political system could really become a problem in terms of advancing these. Now, on the other types of policies, the more specific industrial policy, as I said, I'm not a neoliberal. I'm not against the government intervention. But after decades of working on these issues, I'm impressed that often you get unintended consequences. So I think you have to approach these issues carefully. Certainly in China, like looking at semiconductors, for example, you've got government ministries saying that, you know, China should cut way back on its imports of semiconductors. That's a risky policy because we don't know how quickly Chinese firms can produce the real high end. So you might be cutting your firms off from a key input. You know, so I think those kind of technology-specific industrial policies have to be thought through very clearly. But we have some examples. You know, we just had this amazing effort to build the vaccine. You know, I mean, that's, you know, that was pretty impressive government effort supporting very, very specific technology. Let's create a vaccine that works against COVID-19. And you had competition with at least three Western vaccines. And it looks like there are at least two Chinese vaccines that are pretty effective. So, you know, you can craft clever industrial policies to encourage certain types of outcomes. But I always want to look at the unintended consequences.
Yeah, here, David, if I may add another question from the viewers. Yakuza Kuroi asks about Chinese solutions that in the West could be applied. I think what the question is about is, what are some of the areas where China might quickly be the leader as far as intellectual property rights are concerned and high-end technology? You talked about moving up the ladder. What would be the things that you would choose as strong points and strong paths for China?
I think the most obvious example is AI. I don't think they're there yet. I think, you know, if you just read the press, you often get false impressions. So I don't think they're the leader in AI, but they're pretty advanced and they have a lot of potential. And that may be an area where being an authoritarian country, you know, gives the firm some advantage in terms of access to data and disregard for privacy considerations, et cetera. So in general, I think, I think political openness is supportive of innovation and productivity growth, but there may be some specific technologies where an authoritarian country has an advantage.
How about green technology, solar panels?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the I'm hesitating for a moment. I don't know if I want to attribute to this to authoritarianism because, you know, we've got a number of European countries that have set very impressive carbon goals and are out there meeting them. So I think it's more a question of national will. And I do think the Chinese have gotten very serious about carbon reduction, at least the first phase. You know, people are worried about air pollution. There's still hundreds of thousands of premature deaths every year in China because of air pollution. So I think they've gotten very serious about trying to address that. And in the first stages, that's very much aligned with the carbon reduction agenda, because you have to stop using coal, switch to natural gas, or even better, switch to solar and wind. So they're making very, very impressive investments in installing natural gas plus solar and wind. And then that tends to drive the innovation and the investment. And so I think that national commitment to carbon reduction, you know, if we could get the U.S. to take seriously a national program for carbon reduction, I think it would drive fantastic innovation by American firms. So that's true for all of us. And I think that's an area where we should be very welcoming of competition. You know, so if I gather General Electric and Siemens are fighting it out to create these enormous wind generators, windmills of extraordinary scale beyond anything we've imagined before. So that's great that Siemens and GE are fighting it out, you know, because if whatever productivity enhancement they have there, it's going to benefit all of us.
From our perspective, we acquaint Chinese innovation with their global champions, such as Huawei, Alibaba, Tencent, or Baidu. So over the years, the Chinese government has supported their development, assigning them a priority role in the development of key industries as defined in the Made in China 2025 strategy. The current actions of Chinese regulators against technology companies, especially against Alibaba, may be surprising in this context. What does this show? How do you comment on this?
Right. So all of these are really complicated questions. In this one, the financial part of Alibaba, the Ant Financial, they were starting to do things online that were essentially banking, you know, taking significant deposits, offering higher interest rate than banks, but they weren't subject to banking regulation. So that's not innovation. That's just financial risk. You know, I mean, we have financial regulation for a reason. I actually think China's financial regulation is pretty good. So I have some sympathy for kind of reining in the risky behavior of innovative financial firms and making sure they're properly regulated. But, you know, then, I mentioned that the value of Jack Ma's company's gone down 30%. In just a few months. So that just seems expropriation. That's partial expropriation as far as I'm concerned. So I think you've got a confusing mix of legitimate regulatory issues, you know, but Jack Ma made this high profile speech kind of criticizing various aspects of the government policy. And I think it's credible that Xi Jinping and other leaders, you know, they didn't like having the private sector criticizing them. So they intervened in a way that reduced the value of that company a lot. So I think that's a weakness of China.
To finish this part of our discussion, I want to ask you to create an open initiative system and accelerate the pace of changes. China should encourage its firms to engage in product and process innovation, not only through their own research and development, by participating in the global project and networks. Is there any chance for this, given the current geopolitical situation, conditions?
Well, you know, we have a complex set of global institutions, you know, and some of them kind of fly under the radar screen because they're not that controversial. I worked 20 years for the World Bank, and I guess I wouldn't say the World Bank completely flies under the radar screen, but it's not really a household phrase. People are not that aware of it. But China has developed a very substantial position in the World Bank, which I view as a healthy thing. Most important business of the World Bank is the very concessional lending to low-income countries, most of which are now in Africa. And every 3 years, donors make contributions to fund that because it's concessional, so it has to be subsidized. So the last time we collected money, China was the number six donor, right? So China's up there, not far behind the UK or France, and ahead of, I believe, Canada and Italy, you know. So China's in the middle of the G7 in terms of generosity. And every 3 years when they replenish, the China's been doubling, you know. So, you know, they're financing development through the World Bank. They've got a lot of staff there now. They have different types of collaborations, you know. So I think they are pretty deeply embedded in a lot of different global institutions. And my understanding is they're very active in standard setting. You know, there are a lot of non-governmental bodies that are active in setting standards, and China's always there at the table. You might worry about that a little bit. That it's a country with an enormous number of people, and they seem to be involved in everything. But because they are about 20% of the world population, I think it's basically a positive thing that they're involved in everything.
Yeah, and here, David, I would like to bring up your text in the East Asian Forum from December, where you also conveyed this idea that it's not maybe necessarily China that needs to be a more responsible stakeholder, but rather the US giving more space for China in these international institutions. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on this idea? Because I think it's very rarely seen in world media, especially the Western media.
Yeah, so I'm aware that, you know, China's a good citizen in a lot of these international organizations, you know, and there are different types of governance, but in two of the most important, the World Bank and the IMF, you have a shareholding system. And China has been constrained to having a ridiculously small share, not because they don't want to put money in, but because, you know, to be frank, it's mostly European countries that have been resisting increasing China's weight, and the U.S. has not been helpful. So we expect China to contribute to global public goods like carbon reduction preparing for the next pandemic, but they're not given the weight in these institutions that they deserve. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem. You know, if you talk to the China hawks in the U.S., you know, they would say, China, you can cite a few good things they do, but then there are lots of bad things they do around the world. And, you know, we need to see really kind of stellar behavior from them before we can accept that. And the Chinese view is the West is never going to accept their rise to co-equal status with Europe or with the United States. I think that creates a certain instability in the world.
Maybe the last my question. I'm very interested in your opinion about Belt and Road Initiative.
So I have, a balanced view of the Belt and Road Initiative. I think it has a lot of different components, but it's primarily about financing infrastructure in developing countries. A little bit in Europe as well, but frankly, most of the action is in the developing world. Most of it finances power generation and transport infrastructure like expressways and ports and rail. And developing countries need this infrastructure, and oftentimes the terms are more generous than they could get from the private sector, so it has a certain appeal. But I think we could also criticize it that the Chinese initiative lacks transparency, so it's hard to get accurate information. And then while the terms are more generous than from the private sector, definitely some countries have taken on too much debt. And we see that now. I've got a new paper coming out where just focusing on China's big clients in Africa, about half of them are in debt distress now, going to the IMF for programs, probably going to need debt relief. And so you can argue that this COVID shock was unanticipated, but it's clear that some of these countries have taken on too much debt. China's responsible thing for China to do would be to renegotiate the terms on a lot of that debt. But they're not a member of the Paris Club, by the way. This links back to our last topic. So they don't like the idea of joining the Paris Club because, as essentially run by the OECD, which defines itself as a club of democracies. So if we've got new creditors like China and also other countries, we probably need to create a new club of creditors. And we may have to locate it somewhere other than Paris, even though it's nice to go to Paris for international meetings. Maybe we have to locate that in the developing world somewhere, try to get all the creditors, you know, because some of our old institutions are just not that relevant given the changes in the world, of which the most important is the rise of China.
Right, David, it was very insightful. Thank you very, very much for all the very, very interesting information. I hope our viewers also enjoyed it very much. Thank you for your time. It was a great pleasure to have you in China Talk.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. And I would also like to thank everyone who attend and follows this event. We invite you to the next part of China Talk. Thank you very much.